again, everyone, and welcome to it. It's the Daily Daily Caller Podcast for the 28th day of November 2019. And if you're playing the home game and keeping an old-fashioned calendar, it's Thanksgiving. If you're oblivious to your surroundings and have no idea what's going on, your day's about to get pretty hectic, because I assume you're going to be with somebody eating something. It's not just going to be, huh, it's weird, it's Turkey Day. Unless you have no friends or family, in which case, go out and make some friends and start a family. Yes, Thanksgiving Tryptophan Thursday, the Detroit Lions will play today, and I apologize on behalf of everybody from Michigan for that. It is a best of, and since nothing massive happened in the last 24 hours, there's really not a whole lot to comment on other than for me to go and slip back into my tryptophan coma. Actually, it's early, so get ready to slip into my first tryptophan coma. I love Thanksgiving, and I love the fact that you eat yourself silly, and then like 2 hours later, you see somebody's making a sandwich, and you go, I'll have a sandwich. Yeah, why not? You could probably not eat for the rest of the week, but somebody's having a sandwich. Why not have a sandwich? It's a strange thing about the human condition. It goes into my theory that I'll have to do on a later show, that women have a second stomach somewhere hidden in their bodies. You go out to dinner, they eat, and, oh, I'm stuffed, I couldn't possibly eat another bite, and like half their food is gone, but they're insisting, I'm stuffed, I'm gonna, if I have one more bite, I'm going to explode. And then they come around and say, would anybody care for dessert? And they go, can I see the menu? Can I see the dessert menu? Like, you were just about to split open like that scene in Alien, and now suddenly you've got room for a piece of $15 pie? Ugh, chicks, you know? Am I right? I'm right. Anyway, we have two big interviews today and two big interviews tomorrow. We're doing the best of. I thought we'd go back to the well. We could go get the most famous people that we've interviewed. We could have Ken Starr up there. We could have Tucker Carlson up there. We could have George Gilder, Ann Coulter, Brian Kilmeade, Greg Jarrett, David Limbaugh, Glenn Beck. You name it, we've talked to them. But I thought, let's go deeper into the well. Let's talk about, although, you know, one of them's pretty famous today, I guess. I mean, if you consider Ben Carson famous. So today we have two interviews. First, we have Mark Moreno of Climate Depot. He is the world's foremost knowledgeable person on the issue of climate change. And he is not buying into the left-wing hype. There is not, you can't stump Mark Moreno. That's what I love about him. And he has a very, very enjoyable way to speak. And just a joy to be around. And a funny guy. And a fun guy. He is a happy warrior. And then we talk to Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, a little guy you might have heard of called Dr. Ben Carson, who just so happens, in addition to being a cabinet secretary for President Trump, happens to be the nation's foremost pediatric neurosurgeon, you know, just as a side gig. Actually, he retired and then went in to run an entire department in government. What are you doing with your retirement? Golf? Anyway, both were very interesting conversations. Obviously, climate change is always in the news, and it is going to be in the news even more going forward as we gear up for the 2020 election. So the more you hear of Mark Moreno, the better off we all are. And then, of course, anytime you can listen to Dr. Carson talk, you should definitely avail yourself of that opportunity. They will be played back-to-back, so there's no skipping, and I won't come back at the end to wrap. Well, I guess I will come back at the end to wrap it up. What the hell? It's Thanksgiving. You've got to be thankful. And with that in mind, before we get started, I'm thankful for Life Change Tea, the game changer. It's the tea that makes you go. And by the end of today, you're going to need some Life Change Tea. Just be honest with yourself. You're going to be stuffed up with food. And that's fine, except you're stuffed up with more things that are causing you to not be able to absorb all of the nutrition you should be absorbing from your food. Well, Life Change Tea changes that. It's the tea that makes you go. Don't chug it. Drink as directed. One little packet you brew up, you get like a total in a package of a month's worth. You just drink a cup a day, and it keeps you regular, keeps you going, gets you going, and it cleans you out. cleans you out. You have no idea what's sitting around inside of you and how long it takes to get out. Life Change Tea changes all that. It keeps you regular. Like I said, go to getthetea.com now. Getthetea.com. Get ready for Thanksgiving. I drink it every day. I have a gallon, about a half a gallon of it sitting in the fridge right now. Just a cup a day. Keeps you going. Makes you feel so much better. Helps you restore your energy. All the good things that go into your body you need to be able to absorb. And you got to get all the bad things that go in your body out. That's where Life Change Tea comes in. Enter Derek. In the promo code at checkout. Yes, my name, Derek. In the promo code at checkout, and you get 10% off your order. Give it a shot. Why not? What have you got to lose except for all of that grossness? Plus, you help out the show. So, yeah, there's a charming note to start your Thanksgiving on, isn't it? But I do love Life Change Tea. All right, now, here we go. It's going to be Mark Moreno from Climate Depot. Then it is going to be Dr. Ben Carson from Housing and Urban Development. Then it is going to be the rest of the day is up to you. It's free time. So I'll be back to say goodbye at the end. But here are the interviews. Alrighty, hello again, everyone, and welcome to it. It's the Daily Caller Podcast, a Friday video edition where we grab somebody from their normal lives and bring them into ours to pick their brain, learn some things, expand our horizons. Today is no different. We're joined by Mark Moreno. He's the head honcho of the Big Cheese over at ClimateDepot.com. He's also author of the book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Climate Change. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thank you, Derek. Happy to be here today.
You know more about this stuff than most people. You've forgotten more about it. I always forget how that saying goes. There you go. You've forgotten more about this stuff than most people know about this stuff. Before we get into all the things, because this was supposed to be the week of climate, and there's always a continual push behind it, how did you get involved in this issue?
Well, I come at this, I always like to joke that I'm not a scientist, but I play one on TV.
so do most people.
Yeah, I'm the same as Bill Nye, right? Now, Bill Nye. I come at this as an investigative journalist, and my interest of this is what started. I started in the 1990s as a, actually very concerned about environmental issues, even back to the 80s. And one of my big issues was the Amazon rainforest. If you recall, before global warming was going to kill us, not having the Amazon, the lungs of the earth, et cetera, all these other misleading things they say, was going to kill us and kill all these species. I used to watch the National Geographic documentaries, got very interested. So I started investigating that. It ended up culminating in a big documentary I did in the year 2000 on the Amazon rainforest, where I went down to Brazil, interviewed the environmentalists, and they were throwing down the guidebooks, all the lies in it. It turned out it was the most intact forest on the planet. And that it was nowhere near in danger of disappearing. And even 10 years after that, the New York Times, for every acre of forest cut down, 50 are regenerating. What that told me was when I started studying global warming, I was already skeptical of the environmental movement. I felt betrayed as a kid growing up, seeing all this stuff, we're all going to die, all the tipping points.
You're told about the ozone layer was being depleted. Acid rain was going to kill everybody.
Acid rain, the cities and the pollution and everything. There was no hope or future. And what was amazing that happened was technological advancement. If you go back to the first Earth Day, you'll find we've radically cleaned up our air and water quality while at the same time with having huge economic growth and population increases. It can all be done. In fact, the wealthier a society is, the cleaner a society is. It's in the developing world where we actually, and I've interviewed college kids, University of Minnesota, who go around when I was in Africa for a UN Earth Summit in 2002. She was there telling people, going on a pilgrimage across Africa, telling people using animal carts and living in huts made of dung that they're doing it right. They're living earth friendly. But these people are the ones who are, filling raw sewage in the air. Their kids are dying young, high infant mortality. They don't have modern dentistry. We've got the whole message wrong, but it really is true that the more wealth, the cleaner your environment. So I started, and I didn't have my eye opener until the 1990s on that, and then I became an investigative journalist, did all that work for the United States Senate Environment and Public Works Committee as the communication director, also did a climate report on ended up being over 1,000 dissenting scientists. So started Climate Depot 10 years ago, and that's what I've been doing. And the book came out last year, and a new edition this year on the Politically Incorrect book, with a bonus chapter on the Green New Deal. Maybe next year I'll have a bonus chapter on Greta, who knows?
A non-recycled virgin paper made from fresh pulp, none of that recycled crap. Let's talk a little bit about the environmental movement and where they started to go wrong. Maybe I'm wrong. I sort of ascribe good motives to the founding of most things, and then they just go astray. They go, either they're ignorant, but they're good. They think they're doing right. At what point did, because the earth was much more polluted than it is now.
Yes.
Now they act as though a grocery bag is the worst thing ever done to the world. You can go dump a gallon of mercury in the drinking water. Nobody cares about that. Yeah. It's that plastic bag makes you Hitler. When did the movement sort of go from, hey, let's clean up after ourselves and respect the environment, to let's worship the environment? It doesn't matter what the cost to humanity is. Screw humanity. They're the root of all evil. Let's embrace essentially full communism.
Good question. If you go back to, say, Teddy Roosevelt's presidency, that was the first real mainstream conservation. He set up the national parks. And I think there was a whole era of that conservation that went up, and everything really changed with, I guess you'd call, the conservation environmental movement. What about with Rachel Carson and
the Silent Spring,
and then really with Paul Ehrlich and John Holdren worked together. But Paul Ehrlich's overpopulation scare, that was really the sea change.
1968,
I believe the book was 1966 or something. Yeah. 65 or 66. It was the overpopulation bomb, and that book changed everything, because there was a lot of forces behind the scenes trying to radicalize it. It was also the rise of the 60s campus protests, the cultural Marxism, if you will, rise of political correctness, where everything was changing. But it infected the environmental movement was the alarmism. And Paul Ehrlich started out with all of the doomsday back then, to the point where he was considered by his contemporaries in old newspaper articles that some of his solutions were akin to Nazi Germany. They were talking about putting in
forced sterilization put in the water.
But he would now say, and his defenders would say, well, he wasn't advocating that. He was merely coming up with different possibilities.
Solution of many.
Yeah, it's just possibly. So that radicalized the environmental movement, and it also made it, unscientific, because he came up with all these weird talking, but we're going to have famine by 1980. Within 5 years, London will be a blue steam. We're going to run out of oil in like the next decade. All these predictions, which were absolutely proven false, and he had a bet even with Julian Simon, who was opposed to him, a free market environmentalist, and he lost on every bet about, rare earth minerals and other things they bet on that were not going to be declining, about basically the earth is sustainable the way humans live. So he was proven wrong on every pot, but he still continued to go. And then from there, we jumped into a whole bunch of other environmental issues, from deforestation scare, global cooling. What I found in doing research for the book is, no matter what scare, since the overpopulation scare of the 60s, it's always the same solution.
Yeah.
Sovereignty limiting treaties, wealth redistribution, and central planning. That's it.
I love that. They have a solution in search of a problem. Oh, it's the coming ice age. We've got, here's the set of solutions. Oh, now it's global warming. It's the same set of solutions. The exact opposite things. And some people just go, everything has changed except the solutions. 180 degrees. Okay, we just go along. Why do people have a willingness to accept obviously, Paul Ehrlich's book, The Population Bomb, didn't come to pass. He was talking about death and destruction and mass famine long before now. It didn't come to pass, yet there's still a willingness, the same willingness, I would say, in the mid-60s to embrace that idea that there is to embrace climate change is going to kill us all, the polar ice caps are going to melt, Barack Obama's telling us the oceans are going to rise while he's buying $15 million mansions right on the ocean.
Yes.
Why do we have... Is it they're convincing, or is it something about us as human beings that has us willing to believe that we're all going to die?
No, I think it's the latter, what you just said. It's people have an innate, they almost want to be fearful. They want to be prepared, so they're more willing to accept this kind of doomsday, especially the younger you are. And that's, when you're older, you've seen it all, heard it all. All the polling shows you, the older you are, the more skeptical. The younger you are, the more alarmed. Actually, new polling data this week by Rasmussen shows More than 51% of kids think the Earth is really doomed, and we only have about a decade or so that before it's going to be collapsing. But this is what kids have been taught from kindergarten all the way through, and humans are very susceptible to that message. But global warming is merely the latest scare to have the same exact solutions. That's why it's so funny, the Green New Deal. It's like, all it is recycling what we were talking about in the 60s and 70s. There's literally nothing new or green about it.
I get why kids fall for it. You're told by people in positions where you're supposed to trust them that this is going to happen and they have to work to try and stop it. I understand that. The adults, I can understand it from kind of a power perspective. Yes. But the media, which I know you deal with a lot and have dealt with and used to be a member of, what is the incentive there to the point where you have Chuck Todd going on Meet the Press saying, we're not going to even entertain anybody who is skeptical. Forget denier, the Holocaust term that they've created, but even skeptical, who questions. Now, the very nature of science is to question. Nothing is ever set, yet we now have a purity of thought enforced by the media that the world hasn't seen since the 1930s in Europe. What is the incentive there?
It's amazing. I mean, I can up you, your Chuck Todd, the former CBS news anchor Scott Pelley has said, I will not interview a climate denier on the CBS Evening News for the same reason I wouldn't interview a Holocaust denier. Direct comparisons. And, of course, ABC News had the same type of reporting. CNN used to be more open. I mean, they used to host debates. I debated Bill Nye on CNN primetime. I debated the Sierra Club. They have now shut out all climate skeptics, and as well as all the other major media. LA Times started this, the Washington Times, New York Times. They don't believe that they could possibly allow a debate. And the reason for that is it gets in the way of these solutions, which they're pushing. And it's amazing because even like the recent story on the Amazon about the fires,
right.
That was the sleaziest reporting I had seen. I mean, the Washington Post front page article said it's unprecedented, huge 84% increase in fires. I'm like, how is this possible? I've been to Brazil several times. I've interviewed all this. There's just no way. And you read really closely, and this is what's parroted, 84% year-to-year increase. So 2017, which was an unusually low year, there was a big jump this year. But if you go back, NASA satellites showed it was a below average year to near average in terms of fire. And it gets worse. Bolivia was having, the Amazon encompasses many, I think like 9 countries or 11 countries, depending on how it's defined as the political Amazon or the jungle Amazon. But the other countries where the fires were raging included places like Bolivia, where their president was calling for a environmental court and his real socialist government, who is a massive environmentalist, and the environmentalists love him. There was no criticism of the fires going on there. So that was a purely political issue. And one of the tricks the media does, besides doing the year-to-year and ignoring the big picture, they twice, in this Washington Post front page story on the Amazon, it included an environmental activist and some professor who said, it's the worst fires in my memory. I can't remember anything worse. And I'm sitting there thinking, like, why does a paper, front page article, 2 different quotes about people's memory? You don't need people's memories. We have the actual data.
Right.
We have satellite images. We have satellite scientific data from NASA. This is the way the media cons. And it's all about, in that case, it was about trying to destroy the Brazilian Trump, Bolsonaro, the president of Brazil, because they didn't like him because he's pulling out of the UN Paris Agreement.
One of the things I say all the time is when you control the unit of measure, you always win. And that seems to be what you're saying. If you're I'm pulling at 1% and next month you're pulling at 2%, you're still going
to 100% increase.
But if you come out and say, we've doubled our support or something, it depends on how you want to frame it. So much of what passes as environmentalism and environmental activism is just that. It's the hottest August ever. It's this or that.
That's a good point. That was actually the hottest July is what they claimed. And world record. I'm like, why are they focusing on 1 month? And that's, by the way, only in the land data, not the satellites. And remember, NASA had set up the satellites in 1979, and one of the quotes, I love this, was the satellites are a more accurate way to measure temperatures. That's until they don't show the warming that the land surface does, which is corrupted. So what happened in July, they tried to make it the hottest month. Why? It's called a misdirection. We had a high point basically in 2016 with this massive El Nino. And even with that, if you go back to the late 90s, on many data sets, including the satellite, there's essentially been no change in global temperatures within the margin of error. But so we're on a 3.5-year cooling trend right now since the high point of 2016. How do you misdirect? You start saying, this is the hottest day in Greenland one day. This is the hottest month we've had. It's the same way with polar bears. Polar bears are at or near historic population highs. How do you come out with a report saying it's worse than we thought on polar bears? Well, our predictions of 80 to 100 years are now much worse than they were 5 or 10 years ago. But there's more polar bears than ever. They're showing they're not affected. It doesn't matter. Our predictions are scarier. It's the classic when current reality fails to alarm, make scarier and scarier predictions. They're very good at it. They've been doing it for 50 years.
Talk about that for a second because it fascinates me. And something I wrote in my book is starting back long before that, but the first real big story is 1989. We've got 10 years and we're all doomed.
Yes.
We've gone through three cycles of 10 years and we're all doomed. They used to make those kind of predictions. And if you're the leader of a doomsday cult, say, Tuesday, all life is coming to an end. Come Wednesday morning, you're probably not going to have many followers left, or you're going to have. And that hasn't happened yet with the environmental movement, but they got smart. At some point, they said 100 years. Now it's 100 years. In 100 years, there's going to be more lightning than ever. Who cares? And how do you know? But you can't, not only can't you prove it, more importantly for them, you can't disprove it.
Yes.
The science of climate is not about what has happened or what is happening. It's predictions about what will happen. And if these people are great at knowing the future, I would love some lottery numbers, please. Any of you. Talk a little bit about how the way it's portrayed by both the science community and the media and what the reality is about these models. They're not really fact-based.
I have a whole section in my book on these models. And actually, United Nations scientists admitted, IPCC scientist Jim Renwick's quoted in my book, saying that half of the variability in nature is not accounted for in these models, and they don't expect them to do well. Another huge UN scientist is Dr. Kevin Trenberth. He openly admits that these are not predictions. They're merely emission scenarios. They don't expect to do pretty well. They're just, another scientist called them tinker toys, or Sony PlayStation video games, or equivalent to them, a video game. All they do is that they tune the model to what they assume carbon dioxide is a control knob of the climate, and then they project out and come up with all these scary scenarios. So what they've done here with this, what you'll see, first of all, two things. They'll have the hats now that say 10, 11 years, addressing your tipping point. They actually say like 10 years, 11 years. They had a die-in in Washington, D.C. last week, which I went to where Greta Thunberg spoke. This is before she headed to New York. And they had all these people laying down at the White House gates for 11 minutes. It was a die-in to represent the 11 years we had left. These models are powerful. And then they say, the models say we have 1.5, or we had to keep it under 2 degrees Celsius. In my book, I reveal in the ClimateGate emails, top UN scientists admit that these numbers were pulled from thin air, is the exact quote. That the idea that we can say, well, if we do these kind of emission cuts, the temperature in 2100 will be this. They admit privately to each other that there's no science or any way to support that. It's just a way to rally the public. As Al Gore said last year, the UN reports are torqued up to get the attention of politicians. That's what people
Where does this realize. 12 years we're all going to die come from?
It comes from the most recent UN IPCC report, which came out, which basically said that unless we get the next 12 years are critical, we have to get on the right trajectory, or the runaway global warming is going to occur the next century. And so that was turned in by the media into, we only have this left. But again, the UN's been saying this nonsense. It's absolutely absurd. An Israeli astrophysicist just came out joining other scientists who say, if you look at the Earth's geologic history, carbon dioxide does not control it. Yes, it can warm the atmosphere, but there's hundreds of other factors. There is no way that we can, at the margins, fiddle with one variable in the climate, carbon, man-made CO2, and then expect to have an outcome. But they'll tell you we can. They'll say we need Obama's climate rules. This is what John Podesta had said, because the storms are getting worse, implying that if the EPA does these regulations, the storms will get better. And by the way, on every single metric, hurricanes, tornadoes, floods, droughts, they either on no trend or declining trend going on climate.
Well, after Katrina, Al Gore, they're going to be worse and it's going to keep getting. And then we had 15 years or whatever it was with no landfall.
The longest period, it was a little over 12 years, the longest period of no Category 3, a larger land calling hurricanes, making landfall the longest period since measurements began in the 1850s. And then the very first hurricanes we have, this is what climate change looks like. I did a report going back two decades with every, so this is what climate change looks like. No matter what, it's called climate ambulance chasing. I give that phrase. Joe Bastardi, the meteorologist, came up with it. Same thing that happens with guns. You know, if there's a school shooting or something, they come out of the woodwork. This is what we warned. And, you know, the same thing. But in this case, you know, we had tornadoes in Tornado Alley, of all places.
Yeah, I know.
And Barbara Boxer.
Floods and floodplains? What?
Yes. Barbara Boxer would go down to the Senate floor. This is what we warned you about. We need cap and trade now. As though, you know, passing a cap and trade or carbon tax is going to stop those tornadoes that have been happening. And by the way, we're at record low tornadoes the last 5 to 7 years.
Those models that they want to essentially seize our liberty and our property because of. Correct me if I'm wrong, Mark. If you went back 50 years, theoretically, you should be able to plug in all the data back then, hit enter, and it should show you what happened. Because if you're asking me to go 50 years in the future and base my life now on what's supposed to happen because of this computer model 50 years in the future, you better be able to demonstrate to me that you can predict that with some accuracy. How accurate are their models when you take them in reverse?
Well, interestingly enough, as you might expect, they can tune the models to make the past look like it was accurate in more of a way than they can in the future. The problem here is when they hindcast, and I interviewed many scientists on this, they can't hindcast correctly because there's so many different variables. First of all, there's not only variables that influence the climate. There's so many different temperature data sets, and there's so many different start dates, and there's so many different adjustments. So that's an impossible question to answer. How do they hindcast? It depends on which model you're looking at and how all these other variables that they include in it. But one of the biggest tricks, the National Climate Assessment came out, and this is how they trick you with the models. They used a baseline of 1970. This is a federal climate report that was done during the Trump administration. People say Trump's own scientists disagreed with him. Wait a minute. It was written by Andrew Light, Obama's holdover from the Obama administration, who negotiated the UN Paris Agreement for Obama. And the two lead authors in the report were Union of Concerned Scientists, a far-left environmental group. So my joke was if a federal new report sounds like a press release from environmental groups, that's because it is. But in terms of your question on models, they used a 1970 start date to say, this is how much warming we've had. If this rate continues, our models show, why did they use 1970? 1970 was the height of the coming ice age global cooling scare, where we had CIA reports, where we had scientists warning that we need to dump black soot on the Arctic to
basically
increase
cover
it.
The ice up there to prevent it.
And they were warning that the storms and war and famine were going to be caused by more man-made global cooling. Our aerosols were created, which were blocking the sun. So what they've done, this is how they trick you with these start lines. And the 1970s, if a guy named Tony Heller, an engineer, went back and looked at the National Climate Assessment, and he looked at the data set, went back to the 1930s, you would show a cooling trend or no trend if they had shown policymakers they went back further. But they weren't interested in that. They were looking for the coldest period to show the most
again,
enhanced
warming. You choose
warming
a
trend.
Unit of measure. You're always going to be the tallest, smartest, the funniest, the best looking, whatever it is. One of the go-to arrows in the quiver in shutting down debate, and you know all about being shut down in debate, is 97% of scientists, or whatever it is, 99% of scientists do, as if science is a show of hands. We take a vote, all right, there it is forever. Gravity doesn't exist because we got a whole bunch of scientists.
Voted,
I would love to see a bunch of religious Christians flood the field of biology and then take a vote on when life starts. Conception, and see how embracing of that concept the media would be. But that number two, it's parroted by everybody because it's brilliantly crafted. Anybody can remember it. You just spew it out there, and there's no way to rebut it. So, Mark Moreno of Climate Depot, I want you to give everybody the way to rebut it. Get ready to arm yourselves.
Well, there's two. Okay, first of all, it's 99%.
Right.
Al Gore was just on CNN a couple months ago, and he upped it to 99% of all scientists agree. So 97 is old news. Secondly, the the studies upon which it's based, one of the key studies, which will say 97% of scientists, wasn't even 97 scientists. It was 77 scientists that were whittled down from a statistical base of over 10,000, whittled down to 77 anonymous scientists. Of those, 75 answered the two questions to form the 97% consensus. Interestingly enough, the skeptical scientists I deal with and quote in the book, they all say they would have probably been part of the 97% because the questions essentially came down to, has the Earth warmed and do humans contribute to warming? Not, are we facing a climate crisis? Not, is there a climate emergency? And so this is how they do that con. The other study was a study based on the scientific journal saying 97% of all journals supported this and all the scientists that wrote there. It turns out that number was less than 1% because they just assumed that all these studies, because there was a study on model predictions saying global warming could be worse, that they all agree with the consensus. And that study was examined by a UN lead author who testified before Congress and said that none of the numbers in the study supported the 97%. So you have multiple attempts to get the 97. And here's the kicker. Al Gore was on PBS in 1982 or 84. And he was talking about it's nearly unanimous in the scientific literature. Al Gore, one of his first hearings back when he was a senator, a congressman, a senator from Tennessee, was touting this before anyone had any data on it. So this was a talking point in search of studies. And my favorite was the former science advisor to Margaret Thatcher, Lord Monckton, had said, so they had this talking point for several decades. They came up with a couple of dopey studies to try to support it, and that's all they needed because there was no media scrutiny. So now that's a solid talking point.
And a lie repeated often enough becomes truth to some people. Looking at the current environmental movement, are they winning in the education?
Absolutely.
They are?
They are winning everywhere. I don't know. I'm the nattering nabob of negativity, which is what Spiro Agnew called the media. They're winning everywhere. I'll let you finish your question, but what were you
saying? Well, please, just expand upon that because...
We are losing on every front, not scientifically, but science doesn't matter in this debate. We are losing everywhere, and I'll tell you, in my mind, I think it's gotten worse since President Trump was elected for one simple reason. President Trump has not challenged the premise other than himself. He himself will challenge it. His cabinet is running scared. The only member was his first EPA chief, Scott Pruitt, who stood up, challenged the UN reports, did media interviews. What happened to Scott Pruitt? His own career bureaucratic staff turned against him, started leaking stuff to the media. Every day, the New York Times, Washington Post, daily hit pieces on him. Why? Because he was the only person in official Washington willing to challenge the premise of man. Not let other people, oh, it costs too much, or the Green New Deal is socialism. All true. But if you're not challenging the premise. So what happened was Pruitt was run out of town. He had a bed and breakfast below market rates. He should have paid $22 more a night. He's got to go. He asked people about his wife's Chick-fil-A. Oh, my gosh, a cabinet member trying to use connections to talk. Held him to a standard they wouldn't anyone else. He's run out of Washington. His new EPA chief is Andrew Wheeler. He hired me to work in the United States Senate. Will not only not talk about climate change, he will duck, he will avoid it at all costs. Rick Perry, the skeptical Texas governor, urged Trump to stay in the UN Paris Agreement, says he agrees with Al Gore, they just have different ways of going about it. The NASA head, Jim Bridenstine, was a climate skeptic congressman. Guess what? He's picked for NASA. Right before his hearing, he has Bill Nye go as his guest at the State of the Union. He reverses himself, becomes a believer in climate change. There is not a single member of Trump's cabinet that will speak on climate, other than Trump himself, who does a heck of a job.
Right.
So anyway, we're losing in the schools. We're losing in Congress. We're losing in public opinion. There's no pushback from our government. And people believe if we have the most skeptical president and administration and there's no scientific pushback, there must be something to this. I meet people all the time. Is there still a debate? I mean, how come Trump's not doing anything? They were going to do a climate commission. Trump, according what I'm told, would actually approve the commission, but people like Mick Mulvaney, others, and his staff killed it because they didn't want to. They see going into the science of climate as sort of America's Vietnam, getting involved in a Vietnam quagmire. So then Trump in April said, I thought we approved that. But then they said, oh, we'll do it after the election. So the man who was going to spearhead it, an 80-year-old Princeton physicist, 200 peer-reviewed studies, one of the foremost experts on greenhouse gas, who says we're in a CO2 famine, Dr. Will Happer, just left the administration basically in frustration after 4 years waiting to do this climate commission. It would have been the first report to push back. So that's key reason we're losing. The other reason is Trump hasn't cut an ounce of the money. We're still rubber stamping the UN reports. We're still funding
them.
We're still funding all
the academic reports. Do you think just because it comes out of a university, it's academic? It must be intelligent.
Now, Trump, he announced the intention to pull out. He announced, you know, where he did reverse Obama's executive orders. He reversed EPA stuff, but that can be undone in the first year of the next Democrat administration. There's nothing permanent. And there's everyone in America is afraid to challenge it. No one in office really will. It's only a few congressmen, a few senators. Everyone else is afraid.
Jim Inhofe,
but he's in his 80s now, right. And he's no longer on that committee. So we're few and far between. And even the Republicans now on AOC's Climate Crisis Committee, you know, they had Greta Thunberg. They're all, they're just not willing to push back on that. Yeah, they'll push back. Oh, the planet is about to end. Well, it costs too much to fix it, and it's socialism. That's a message that can only go so far. You know, right. you gotta challenge their premise, and the premise is rotten. The UN is a lobbying organization, and you go through and see how the sausage is made, and it's appalling. The former head of the UN climate panel said, quote, global warming is my religion, and this is supposed to be their science panel.
You first came, and we'll wrap it up on this. Sure. You first came to Prime. I could listen to you all day. We don't have all day, sadly. You first came to prominence as part of the debate. There was a debate over this. And you would be on television. You would be, I'd imagine, go around the country and have discussions with people at universities. Can't do that anymore. I had John Lott in here from the Crime Prevention Center.
Yes.
And he said that the Every Town for Gun Safety and the Brady campaign, they won't appear on TV.
Same exact thing.
They
don't want to legitimize. Here's why. In the climate debate, here's why. In 2007, they had a major New York City debate between the current head of the NASA Global Warming Temperature Data, is Dr. Gavin Schmidt. This is your disinterested science just looking at the data. He's come out for a carbon tax. He's essentially announced as the NASA head that he wants to see a carbon tax. He's gotten political. The man who preceded him was arrested at least half a dozen times and endorsed a book which suggested getting rid of industrial civilization was the solution to climate change. This is who's in charge of our temperature data. Anyway, the NASA head guy debated Michael Crichton and an MIT scientist. 3-on-3 debate, New York City. They polled the audience overwhelmingly before the debate that global warming was a crisis. 90-minute debate later, the audience in New York City in 2007 flipped. Global warming was not a crisis. Then current lead NASA scientist publicly announced that we should not be doing any more debates, that we lost this one, that it doesn't serve the cause. And that's when it all started. They started, and that became, by like 2015, that became the whole memo. That went everywhere. His colleagues, they don't want to debate because they lose. B, it puts doubts in people's head, and C, they don't want to legitimize the evil climate deniers, in quotes.
Which is all part of the scientific method, if I understand the science.
And the same thing happens in journals. They'll say, only the peer-reviewed journals. Well, gee, these are the same ones which we know, which they publicly release in the climate case. Well, if that journal editor publishes that, we'll blacklist that journal. How dare they do that? That guy can't publish. We see what was happening behind the scenes. They were intimidating them. And they run the show because they're getting the money. This is the top echelon of the UN scientists. They get the money. They pick all the conferences. Academia has to rely on that. I mean, it is so far, I don't want to say lost, but we are so far from winning, it's not even funny.
The truth is out there, and you can find a ton of it in the Politically Incorrect Guide to Climate Change, climatedepot.com. Mark, I could pick your brain forever. I thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for today. Check out climatedepot.com all the time. It's the hysteria. You're being lied to and manipulated. Have a great weekend on that charming note. We'll see you back here on Monday. All right. Hello again, everyone, and welcome to it, the Daily Caller podcast. I'm Derek Hunter. I am your host. And as we always do, we bring somebody into our world who's far more successful and interesting than we are, except this time we thrust ourselves into somebody else's world. Joining me today is Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Dr. Ben Karst. Mr. Secretary, thank you for coming on. Thank you for agreeing to this.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
I don't know what you would have gotten had you won the bet, but I appreciate you coming on here. Before we get into policy and accomplishments, I want to talk about biography, a little bit about you. You and I have very similar stories in that we were both born in Detroit and then moved to Baltimore later in life. We wildly diverged after that. You went on to become successful, and I'm sitting here. But talk about your upbringing and how your upbringing helped prepare you for a public life.
Well, you know, there were a lot of things that I think prepared me along the way. First of all, you know, when my parents got divorced, I was 8 years old. That was incredibly devastating. But, you know, my mother only had a third grade education, so we had to move, had to find some place to go. We didn't have any place to go. We ended up being taken in by some relatives in Boston. And it wasn't a particularly pleasant environment. It was multifamily, ghetto, rats, roaches, violence, gangs. Both of my older cousins were killed, that kind of environment. And then adjacent to a public housing complex where my cousins lived, we frequently went there after school. I was a terrible student. Really didn't think that I could accomplish. And my mother was working extraordinarily hard.
But when you were a terrible student, did you know you could do better and refused as a sort of rebellion, or did you think that was the best you could do?
No, I just didn't think that I could do any better, so I really didn't try very hard. And, you know, after a couple of years, we moved back to Detroit, still in a pretty awful neighborhood. But at least my mother was independent at that time. Mm. And I was still a terrible student, but it was really her making us read books. She was a spy. She said that she was a domestic, and she'd go from one house to the next house cleaning. But she was really spying on those people, and she wanted to know what made them so successful. And she concluded that it was because they did a lot of reading, a lot of studying and planning. So she came home and imposed that upon us. And,
but she couldn't read herself.
She couldn't read herself, no.
And what was it like when you found out your mother couldn't read after your mother making sure that you read? You thought, well, because she would quiz you on the books.
Yes.
She had no idea whether or not you were telling the truth.
Well, she was very smart. She could pull the wool over anybody's eyes.
That's a sign of a good parent. You got to do half of that.
Absolutely. But I was actually even more impressed with her when I found out that she couldn't read and that she was trying. And she started going to school, going to night school. And interestingly enough, she got her GED the same year I graduated from high school.
It's a great story. And then, of course, you went on to become a world-famous neurosurgeon, separating conjoined twins at the head, first time ever. Everybody knows your biography there. I want to ask you a little bit about the National Prayer Breakfast speech that you gave, because it just happened again.
Right.
It was sort of your political coming out party. You were famous before that.
Right.
There had been a movie made of your life. Your accomplishments were known, but not as widely known as that speech that you gave, critical of Obamacare, in front of the President of the United States. When you gave that speech, you were reaching the end of your medical career.
Right.
Were you planning on making a move to politics, or did the reaction to that say, hey, wait a second, maybe I could do this?
No, actually, I was very surprised when I got the invitation to speak, because I had spoken at the National Prayer Breakfast in 1997, when President Clinton was in office. And I wasn't aware that anyone ever did it twice. But some investigation showed that one person had done it twice, and that was Billy Graham. And I said, wow, that's pretty good
company. Pretty good company, yeah.
And, but I didn't know what I was going to say until the morning of the prayer breakfast, which caused some anxiety on behalf of the organizers. But I said, I'm sorry, I don't know what I'm going to say. But it was crystal clear to me at that point. And I said it, and it resonated so much with...
Did you expect it to? Did you think it could?
I didn't think it was going to be a life-changing event.
Right.
But after that speech, every place I went, you know, there were people with placards, run, Ben, run. I had over 500,000 petitions in my office. And I finally said, you know, this is ridiculous. I don't want to run for president. And I prayed, and I said, Lord, you know, people run for president, they have a Rolodex with a lot of connections and a lot of money, and they have an organization. I said, I don't have any of that stuff. So I said, if you really want me to run, then provide all that stuff. Boom, overnight, I had all that stuff. We were bringing in more money than the RNC every month. It was ridiculous.
Well, it blew up, but
you were up at in Baltimore, which is a very liberal town. The reaction, as excited as some people were for the prospect of you running,
right.
There were a lot of people who were angry at you for, in their minds, existing wrong.
Right.
You were uninvited from speaking at mm-hmm. the commencement of the Johns Hopkins Medical School.
Right.
Talk a little bit about the dichotomy between the two, and I think that's sort of an indication because we've really gotten even further apart since then.
Well, you know, there is a strange culture in our country where if you become known as a conservative, then everything that you do is done for an nefarious purpose. And you never would do anything because it's the right thing to do. That's how a lot of people on the left feel. And, you know, I don't spend a lot of time worrying about them. I just spend a lot of time thinking about what is the right thing to do. So I recognize fully that, you know, running for president, subsequently taking on the job of Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, that would take a lot of people and create enemies of them. Mm-hmm. Now, they're not my enemy, but I become their enemy.
Right.
Because of who you associate with. And you just recognize that that's a peril, and you ask yourself, is it worth it? And I started thinking about it, and I said, which is the direction that our country is going in, and what are the implications for our future, and what's going to happen to our children and our grandchildren? It was really when the grandchildren came along that my wife got on board. She said, we can't just let this go on and let them have to suffer the consequences. So, you know, I think it is a very worthwhile thing, and I think about the sacrifices that many of the people who founded our country went through. You take somebody like John Hancock, a very successful businessman who was willing to give up everything. Benjamin Franklin, willing to take money out of his own pocket to pay for the Boston Tea Party because he didn't want the wrath of the English. I mean, it's amazing what people sacrificed and were willing to go through.
I want to ask you, we're going to switch into your current position, but I love asking this question of people who have made major transitions in your life. Before you became Secretary of Health, of Housing and Urban Development, I imagine you thought you knew what the job would be like, or you had some sort of general idea. What's the biggest difference between what you thought it would be like and what it's actually like?
Probably the biggest difference is how much interaction you have to have with other parts of the government to get things done. If you could do everything on your own, you could do things very efficiently and very fast. But, you know, this group has to check it off, and then this group has to check it off, and then you have to come back and redo this, and it takes forever to get things done.
If a hospital ran this the way government does,
everybody would die.
That's what I was trying to get, because you're on the President's Affordable Housing Council, correct? Which you would think would be run out of here, but is it run out of the Treasury Department?
Well, actually, the Affordable Housing Council is still in the process of being put together. The Opportunity and Revitalization Council is the one that is being run out of here.
It's such a gigantic thing. How are you finding handling it? Because, I mean, you're working as a neurosurgeon, you work alone, you have a couple of people that hand you things that do exactly, his life's on the line. Here, you can't do anything alone.
No, you can't. And, you know, it's interesting because when I took this position, you know, a lot of critics were saying, he doesn't know anything about this or this or this, and how can you possibly run an agency like that? And it actually demonstrates their ignorance, because the secretary of an agency is more like the CEO of a medical center. CEO of a medical center has to coordinate, plan, and strategize for lots of different divisions, cardiac surgery, infectious disease, anesthesia. Doesn't mean he's an anesthesiologist or an infectious disease specialist or surgeon, but has to be able to coordinate all of that to make it work effectively.
How have you found moving the bureaucracy in the direction that you and the president want this department to go? Is it Sisyphus? Is it pushing a rock up a hill? Is it? Describe the process, because people have gone up against bureaucracies as a customer.
Right.
They've never actually tried to change one from the inside.
Is it easy? No, it is definitely not easy. But I have been so blessed to have just terrific people here with me. I have, without question, the best people of any agency in Washington, D.C.
And you're just saying that because some are in the room.
No, it has nothing to do with that. And it really has made it a whole lot easier. When we sit down and we strategize, we plan what needs to be done, how it needs to be done, we get the collective buy-in of people who've been here for decades, along with people who just are good people with very good ideals and know how to execute. And it's working. But I would be amiss if I told you that it was easy. The bureaucracies don't like to change.
No, no, they do not. And you came into a difficult position in the midst of still a very long recovery of the housing market. We had a bubble in 2008. People out there lost a lot of money, a lot of homes underwater, some of whom have not recovered yet, as well as new people entering the hopeful home buying market. I'm in the hopeful home buying market myself. What is the role of government, and what can government do to help sort of make housing affordable? Because a place like San Francisco, there's a massive homeless problem.
Mm-hmm.
Public housing would help those people, but a square foot of land costs more than the GDP of some countries.
Right. Well, you know, government has to be smart. They have to be analytical, and they have to learn how to use data appropriately. You know, 10, 15 years ago, when everybody was saying everybody should be in a home, and they started messing around with credit scores and all kinds of things, and you put a lot of people into homes that they couldn't afford.
Mm-hmm.
As a result of that, today, in some communities like the African-American community, you have fewer homeowners than you had then. You know, so when the government does things in a manner that is not analytical, it can sometimes be quite detrimental. So what we have to do is ask ourselves, what is the barrier that keeps us from being able to build affordable housing? And what you'll find is that there are these horrific zoning restrictions and other regulatory barriers, environmental things, that add so much cost to the production of a unit that it makes it unaffordable for a large portion of the population. So what we really need to concentrate on is how do we remove those barriers, and how do we re-educate people? And, you know, some of it comes from NIMBYism, not in my backyard. Mm. And I understand NIMBYism very well. People say, you know, my biggest investment is my home. I don't want some gigantic public housing thing built next to me. Well, what they don't realize, of course, is that we don't do that anymore. The government used to come in with a big bucket of money and build these things and then walk away while it immediately started deteriorating. That's not done anymore. Now it's much smaller. It built in a way that's consistent with the architecture of the neighborhood. It's built in an appropriate place in the neighborhood, not in the middle of the block of single-family homes. And it makes it possible for policemen and firemen and teachers and nurses to live in the same communities in which they work and not drive 30 miles away.
And that's getting more and more difficult. A listener, Lisa, said that she would ask you, what is the role of HUD and how do in getting young people the means necessary to afford their first home?
Mm-hmm.
I think HUD flies under the radar with a lot of people. They don't know what it does.
Well, we're very concerned about the young people, and that's one of the reasons that we've been working hard on the condominium rule so that it will make it possible, because that's the first step for many people in the home ownership realm. And we will have that done pretty soon, that first step. It makes a big difference. But again, the whole affordability issue and looking at innovative ways to provide housing, accessory dwelling units, converting garages, shared homes, 3D printed houses.
Really?
Yes. Manufactured housing. This is an area we should just think about trailers. Manufactured housing has just zoomed in terms of technology. And a lot of manufactured houses now look better than site-built houses, and they withstand natural disasters better. They're about 30% less expensive. So these are all things that are being worked on right now, which will make it much easier for people to get into the home ownership realm.
One of the things that makes it harder to own a home, this is a listener, Karen, a tough question for you. She's wondering about how we can possibly uplift the value of the nuclear family and head of household fathers in society. A nuclear family, an intact family, has a much easier time getting a home and getting out of public housing. Mm-hmm. I know that that's something that's near and dear to your heart.
Right. Well, you know, there was a Brookings Institute study, a large study on poverty. And they concluded that there were three things that a person could do that would reduce their likelihood of living in poverty to 2% or less. Number one, finish high school. Number two, get married. Number three, wait until you're married to have children. There are some valuable principles there. And, you know, in our housing policies for decades, we've had some perverse incentives. For instance, if you make more money, you immediately have to report that so that your rent can be jacked up. If you bring another income-producing person into the environment, your rent goes up. If you get married, you probably lose your subsidy altogether.
Did you find that the policies that were in place when you came in were sort of designed to perpetuate people's dependence on government rather than, you know, a leg up?
Well, you know, I hoped that that wasn't the reason it was done, but that was certainly the effect. But we're in the process of disentangling all that right now.
Drew wants to know, what's the difference between urban development and gentrification? One, everybody wants one and everybody condemns the other.
Right. Well, gentrification, of course, means you're moving out, you know, people who are economically disadvantaged, and you're bringing in people who are advantaged, and therefore changing the character of the place. What we want to do instead is create mixed income neighborhoods, holistic neighborhoods that have all the appropriate support mechanisms within them, so that people who want to live in the cities can live in the cities. People who want to live in the suburbs can live in the suburbs. The assistance that we provide in terms of rent, we want that to be something that's acceptable everywhere. We've started recently a national survey of landlords to see what keeps them from wanting to accept vouchers. And we found some very interesting things, like in one area, the city guaranteed all the landlords that if the voucher recipients damaged their property, that the city would repair it. The resistance to vouchers went from there to there, just like that. And it was interesting because most of the people with vouchers are not going to tear your property up.
No,
in fact, they're interested in making sure that they're good tenants so that they don't lose it.
Right. It's a weird thing. It's one story presented as the norm. It's always the worst case scenario presented as the norm.
Yeah.
Chris has an interesting question outside of the realm of HUD. He said, if you'd comment on the press comments regarding the supposed chaos in the White House and a little bit about President Trump's management style. His other secretaries, cabinet levels, there's been a lot of turnover. You're still here. You seem to be getting along well with the president. Mm-hmm. Are these reports overblown? Is there some truth to it? Is there autonomy, or is the president involved in what's going on?
There's not as much chaos as people would have you believe. Certainly not generated through the White House. But there is turmoil. You know, I know a number of secretaries who, you know, like myself, have been accused of things. And when that happens, you know, they have to hire counsel. These counsels are like $800, $900, $1,000 an hour.
Yeah.
And not everybody can afford
that. It's
just
an accusation. That's all it is. You just accuse somebody of something.
Right.
And suddenly you have to defend yourself.
And, you know, once the bills get so high, you say, you know what? I think I'll go back into private life. And that's happened to a number of people. It's totally unfair, totally unreasonable. But, you know, that's why it's called public service and sacrifice. I hope at some point we become a little more mature.
You think we weaponized sort of the grievance and the process there? Because anybody can file make an accusation.
We have. And I personally am very concerned about the implications of that for the future of our country, because I want good people to go into government. Mm-hmm. I don't want them to say, is it really worth it? Am I going to be savage? Is my family going to be disadvantaged? You know, that shouldn't be the case.
You have a great relationship with the president, though, working relationship?
I do. We have a very strong relationship.
You happy with the job? You going to stick around for a while?
I will certainly be here through this term.
Through this term. Now, through this first term, when you look back on it 2 years from now, what do you think will be your greatest accomplishment? Has it happened already, or are you on the cusp of it? What are you going to be most proud of?
It's in the process of happening. One of the things that we did is we brought in a CFO. For 8.5 years, there had been no CFO here. There were not appropriate financial controls in place.
Lost money.
A lot. Can you imagine the billions of dollars that flow through here with no CFO? So putting those things in place has changed.
Is it corruption or incompetence?
Both. There were a lot of corruption on the outside, mm-hmm, because there weren't financial controls, and so money could, you know, be fungible here and there. That was not good.
Well, hopefully you can get this house in order and our housing in order. Dr. Ben Carson, Secretary Carson, more impressive titles than I'll ever have. I appreciate your time. Thank you so much for talking to us.
It's been a pleasure to be with you.
Two smarter, nicer people you couldn't possibly want to meet or know unless I were cloned. Yes, Mark Moreno and Dr. Ben Carson, Secretary Ben Carson. Again, he's got way more impressive titles than I will. Occasionally, somebody accidentally calls me sir and it weirds me out. So I'm never going to be in line for I'm never going to get an honorary degree. But if I did, I'd be insufferable and force people to call me doctor. I have a certificate to prove it. Anyway, that is it for today. Thank you for listening. Hope you have a great Thanksgiving. And if you're listening to this while driving, I hope you don't have to drive more than an hour. I hope you're almost there. Man, go eat. Go to sleep. Go do something. It's Thanksgiving. Enjoy the weekend. Tomorrow, another show on Black Friday, also known as Trample Day. See you then.